Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
Hello, it's Monday, 23rd of October, 2023. It's 1 week after Polish elections that brought about a fundamental change after 8 years of the rule of the law and justice. The opposition parties altogether won 248 seats in a 460-seat parliament and are bound to form a new coalition government. This change in Poland takes place in the context of historical unprecedented events. Russia continues to attack Ukraine and is being successfully repelled by Ukrainian defenders. And at the same time, the eyes of the world look at Israel and the Gaza Strip after the brutal, barbaric attack of Hamas terrorists and the expected response by Israeli defense forces. But is it going to be really that easy to build back democracy in Poland after 8 years of the liberal project that deliberately dismantled the institutional setup that was meant to provide free and fair elections and impartial public space? We're recording this conversation with a very special guest for the Visegrad Insight podcast, and I think you'll enjoy this show. I'm Wojciech Przybylski, and I'm editor-in-chief of Visegrad Insight.
I'm Anne Applebaum. I'm a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine and a historian, the author of books on Soviet and East European history. Looking forward to this conversation.
Welcome to the podcast, and welcome again. You've been on Visegrad Insight podcast already once before with Agnieszka Homańska. It was a great interview, but in a situation we would probably describe a totally different politically in Poland and for Central Europe. And here I wanted to start off by asking you, what has changed over the past couple of months when you look at Poland and Central Europe? What are your thoughts exactly, you know, after a very tense campaign months and after seeing the result in the Polish elections?
So I should start by saying that the Polish election was an unfair election. It was designed so that the government, the ruling party, could win as easily as possible. They used numerous outlets of state media in an extraordinarily biased way that I think outsiders even have trouble understanding. It's not just a little bit of bias. It's a constant streams of attacks on the leaders of the opposition, on their motives and on their supposed treason. You know, it's a very vicious form of propaganda. They used millions and millions, hundreds of millions of euros in state company money to pay for their campaign online and offline. Some of it we could see in the form of posters and so on. Some of it was online messaging. They made small changes to the electoral law, and in one case didn't update the way votes are counted and seats are distributed, so that people voting in the countryside essentially had more power than people voting in the cities. They made it easier to vote in the countryside. So, for example, I vote in the countryside. We walked in and out of our polling station, which serves, I think, 250 people in 5 minutes. But famously, there were very, very long lines to vote in the cities and at foreign consulates, where the ruling party knew that these would be places where lots of people would vote for the opposition. All of that was designed to skew the result so that law and justice, the ruling party, would win, and yet they didn't win. People, I think, are going to be studying this campaign for a long time. I've been already asked a lot about it by Americans and by other Europeans. What happened and why? Why didn't the slogans of autocratic populism and the tactics of autocratic populism succeed? The slogans being, they ran their campaign on the idea that the opposition would bring mass immigration into Poland, that only they stood for sovereignty and for safety. And this is the kind of language that a lot of people especially in places where there is a lot of political turmoil or uncertainty have found convincing in many countries. But it didn't work. I have several guesses. I mean, we'll study it over time. One of my guesses is that they overdid the propaganda. It was so crude and so ludicrous that there were memes and little video clips going around before the election that were parodying it. You know, there was an interview of a, you know, supposed state TV guy, and, you know, in which he doesn't let the opposition person in the video talk at all. And that, you know, I said to a friend of mine, you know, I know this is supposed to be a parody, but actually that's exactly what it's like. That's when you watch them on TV, that's what it looks like. And in particular, they ran in the final week of the campaign, there was a debate, which was not a debate at all. It was a weird, you know, stiff, you know, everybody had 50 seconds to answer questions that were ludicrously biased. You know, on the one hand, you can choose light and happiness and glory with the ruling party, or you can choose, you know, chaos and disaster with the opposition. And those, literally, there were five questions that were more or less organized like that. And I think people finally saw through it. I have a, you know, even people who supported peace in the past and law and justice in the past, I think they, you know, they could see that, you know, this is not how you run a television station. So I think that was one answer. I think another answer was that the opposition had won really consistent across the three opposition parties. There was one or two very consistent themes. And one of them was fear that, you know, if law and justice stay in power, that Poland will leave the European Union. And there was legitimate reason to be afraid of that. They have said as much. One of their magazines, the one that they sponsor, came out and said as much in the few days before the election. They attack the EU. They fight with the EU. They failed to get money from the EU because they refused to obey the rules of the EU. So there was lots of, it wasn't mythical. It was something that people felt was real. I think that motivated a lot of people who felt that the election was a kind of civilizational choice. You know, you can be in the civilization of the West with Europe, or you can be in some weird no man's land, you know, in between Europe and Russia, where who knows if you're safe or what you're, you know, whether you can trade with anybody. And I think people felt strongly about it, especially younger people. And then I would say the second issue that motivated people were women's rights issues. Huge numbers of young people, especially young women, voting. And if you look at the go from 2019 to 2023, a shift in women's votes from law and justice to the three opposition parties. And you know, those seem to be big motivations. I think especially because in you know, it wasn't that long ago we had these very large women's marches in Poland. I went to one of them in this town of Szubin, which is a very small town in northwest Poland near where we live. And it was enormous. I mean, there were hundreds of people. And we asked the mayor of Szubin, who's a friend of ours, how this compares to other political events in Szubin. And he says nothing ever like it before. You know, so, and for, I think, a lot of young women, the marches were the first political experience they had. And I think that was transformative for that generation. And these were marches against a very, very harsh abortion law, so harsh that doctors have let women die rather than give them abortions. I think those two things combined with a series of scandals, people's awareness of nepotism and of corruption, a lot of that made people angry. I think those were the motivating factors. We can talk about it more.
Sure. And thanks for bringing those up. Indeed, I couldn't agree more. These are, first of all, surprising results from the point of view of this playing field that has been designed by PIS to control the elections rather to allow for competition. And yet we have seen so much data, political sociology, that has been empowering. Partly also funny. Viktor Orban was discovered after the campaign to have been personally invested with his anti-migration narratives into the PIS campaign that, as you said, blew it. There was only 19% of the PIS voters deciding to vote for PIS based on this narrative, according to the exit polls of one of the private companies, and only 1.5% were of the opposition voters. So again, 1.5, nearly 2% of the voters fought in the opposition, who they thought that it is really important. Somehow it was deciding factor. And the participation of female voters, which has been consistently high in the past, now went even higher and went just 1 percentage point, but still it's almost 2 percentage point higher than participation of male voters. We had the number of, a lot of statistics and a lot of data, as you say, needs to be dwelled upon. Now, I wanted to ask you, what would you say is the most needed avenue to secure and to consolidate democratic move? This is only a beginning in Poland, and I think we should understand how the challenges mount ahead for restoring institutional democracy in Poland, and or restoring and building it anew, frankly speaking. How would you say, you know, how big is that challenge? And looking back also into the American experience post-Trump, how big is that a challenge for governance, for the political sphere?
So I think it's actually a much bigger challenge. I mean, Trump didn't succeed in damaging U.S. institutions to the same degree that peace succeeded in damaging Polish institutions. I think we're almost, it's almost comparable to a kind of post-1989 scenario where there are a series of major institutions that will need to be altered, starting with the state media, which I think needs totally remaking. I mean, not just, we can't just take them out and put, you know, pro-opposition journalism in. There has to be a new thinking of what public media is, how it can be used, how it can be used to build trust, and so on. I mean, that's one institution. I mean, obviously the courts that have been so badly damaged by peace will need to be dealt with. I mean, and this is, I understand, is a very complicated legal problem. We now have dozens of illegally appointed judges. What happens to them? How can the courts be taken back when we have the president who will veto any change? There's still peace president. And we still have very large, parliamentary opposition. They will be a large and vocal and difficult opposition. So, I mean, there's a series of difficult hurdles. There are also the security services, which, peace have badly abused. They've been, you know, the Poland has a corruption bureau that has been used to harass people. And even this week, there are stories that maybe they've been bugging bugging some of the political opposition leaders. We don't know yet whether that's true, but it wouldn't be surprising because they've done it before. So they use the sort of fake excuse that they're investigating corruption in order to put spyware on the phones of their political opponents, or to launch financial investigations of their political opponents. And this is, you know, we know many people who have been subjected to this, including us. So I should say, I'm sure you've mentioned this, but I'm married to a Polish politician, and that's my, so I have, I see this story both from the inside and the outside. And taking that back will be very complicated. It will require knowing who's who and sorting through a huge mess. And that's another piece of it. The military was used for political purposes in this campaign. That's going to have to be sorted through. And then there's the question of state companies and the civil service, all of which have also had their personnel, talented and technically competent personnel were replaced by placeholders and people's cousins and party members. And a lot of those, particularly the state companies, were used to fund party projects. That all will be massively difficult to undo. And of course, we haven't even got to the point where there's a new government yet. And I foresee several obstacles could appear to that as well. The president has said he won't convene the new parliament until after November the 11th, which was a strange choice. Some of you will know that November the 11th is a national independence day in Poland. It's also historically been the time when the far right goes on marches in Poland. And so we may see some kind of very big or violent march. There are some fears around what that's going to mean. And the president has also not yet said clearly that he will appoint, Donald Tusk, who's the de facto leader of the opposition, as the candidate for prime minister. So there may be several attempts of peace to sabotage the new government, maybe to delay the government, maybe to push it into the new year so that there has to be, they can't pass a budget. I mean, there are all kinds of theories about what they're going to try and do, swirling around. Maybe they want to have a new election, lots of ideas. It's going to be very important for outsiders again to hold piece to their, you know, to their democratic obligations. You know, I think another thing retrospectively is that the EU's not always hard, but and not always forthright, you know, but nevertheless, you know, real stance against the deformation of the Polish courts was, I think, important. You know, there was a lot of controversy and argument inside the EU about whether Europe should say something about internal Polish politics and whether they should block, you know, Polish, you know, money that was supposed to go to Poland because of these rule of law issues. And I think in retrospect, it turns out that that was a good idea. I mean, it worked. It created some resentment against the EU, that is true, but it also meant that a lot of people see the EU as something that stands for rule of law in Poland. And, you know, I hope the EU doesn't have to play a role in the transition process, but you never know. So we aren't there yet. There's a really difficult road to climb. It's really about, you know, it's not so much democratizing the state. I mean, I think it's about returning state institutions that are supposed to belong to both parties to some kind of neutrality. So what peace did was to capture the state. And the state needs to be, you know, to belong to everyone. The civil service needs to be, you know, institutions that are, that needs to be based on meritocracy. You get the job of measuring, you know, pollution in the Vistula because you know about pollution and not because you're someone's cousin. You know, and I know there's always, it's never perfect, the way these kinds of jobs are given out. And the same is true of state companies, and the same is true of the state media. And making all those state institutions public institutions again is a very, very big project on par with the big changes that happened after 1989.
Right. And while Poland is remaking its democracy anew, or basically refurbishments big scale, there are challenges in the world system and the global world order disorder that are also super important for the situation in which Poland is. We have been listening carefully across both sides of the Atlantic, but specifically, I think, in Poland and Ukraine to the recent speech by Joe Biden, in which he was preparing a package of support to Israel and to Ukraine. And in the same message, he was also speaking of the necessity to support both, because the next in line, should the U.S. or NATO overall fail in supporting those two, are Poland and the Baltics, which President Biden mentioned because they were referenced much earlier by Vladimir Putin. To what extent, how this security environment, because ultimately it is about security for Poland and wider Central Eastern European region, is allowing, you think, for making it quick and efficient, rebuilding democracy, or it may be tempting to go for some shortcuts and, you know, the dangers of cutting through, I don't know, individual liberties, freedoms, institutional order are also there because we have a security situation. Do you think?
Yes, the security situation might mean that things have to be done really fast in a way, you know, and there. Also, I'm sure that because it's going to be difficult and there are so many obstacles, not everything will, it may be that we don't succeed in every aspect or in every possible way. I'm not sure the security situation itself is the big problem. I mean, the big problem is the enormous opposition and resistance from within the institutions that have been captured, from peace as a political party, which still has a lot of clout and a lot of members, from the president of Poland, who comes from peace and is affiliated with them and has more or less said he's going to continue supporting them. And so there's all of that makes everything difficult. I mean, the security situation does make things more urgent, but it doesn't change the shape of what needs to be done.
No, I agree. I think it's important to mention that security has been particularly in the focus of the PIS voter base, and specifically in the northeast of Poland, in the regions that are close to the border of Belarus and Russia, where there will be challenges also to how reestablish civil society and uniformed services cooperation in order to deliver both security and humanitarian aid. But these questions are the difficult questions of today globally, not just in Poland. But somehow here will be the spotlight. I wanted to ask you last question still in the global context, on what Poland should hope for. Is it something that we should hope for and work towards to making a transatlantic link even better? There seems to be obvious focus on Poland, naturally because of the war in Ukraine and the hub Poland has become as a host and our society to the Ukrainian refugees, and the state as a provider of logistics that is necessary to upkeep Ukrainian effort. What more can Poland possibly achieve being the most pro-American nation in the world? Pew Research Center, GMF Trends indicate that. Buying American equipment and hoping for success of democracy effort led by U.S. worldwide, where Poland should capitalize further on this relation? Where should Polish foreign policy eyes be?
So I think there's a lot that Poland can do actually for its relationship to the United States by improving its relationship to Europe. Poland as a Atlanticist voice inside Europe and Poland as a close and strong supporter of Ukraine inside Europe is so much more powerful than a kind of, weird, angry fringe Poland that, is somehow different from and cut off from other European countries. I mean, Poland will simply have much more influence from within the EU, from a position of closeness to Germany and to France, especially, but also to Scandinavia and to the rest of Europe. It will simply be more influential. Its advice will be heeded. Its influence will matter a lot more. And that's something I feel really confident that whoever is the next prime minister and whoever is in the next cabinet, that will happen. And as an advocate for American views in Europe and as an advocate for Ukrainian views in Europe, Poland can play a really important role. I mean, there are some deals to be done. I mean, this is, there needs to be real thought about changing any voting regulations in Europe. It's something Poland and Germany should do a deal over and consult closely over. There is going to be, in the run-up to possibly admitting Ukraine to the EU, there is an enormous amount to negotiate. And people are sort of brushing over how difficult that's going to be. But having a Poland which is cooperative and is seen as a power broker inside Europe will make all of that a lot easier. And I think that will be appreciated by the United States as well. So, I mean, it's a... I think there's a lot of knitting together that Poland can do as a country that has more friends rather than very few friends, and I hope that they'll be able to do that. That will change fairly quickly. I mean, there is, of course, I can imagine there'll be a lot of it's not really distrust. I mean, there'll be some doubt about Poland in Brussels and Berlin and Paris. How much has Poland really changed and how long until, another difficult peace government comes back? I mean, that, it may be that Poland has lost quite a lot of the stature that it had 8 years ago, and maybe some of that can't be recovered. But I still think that there's a lot that can be achieved just by a government that seeks cooperation rather than a government that seeks dissent and makes itself difficult, partly just for the reasons of domestic politics. I mean, much of peace's anti-German language was really just for the benefit of its voters. And it was not for the good of the country or anybody else. And so I hope there's a bigger role that Poland can play in all these, both vis-a-vis Ukraine, both in Europe and with the U.S. and in knitting those three worlds together.
Thank you. We'll be watching that closely because indeed I think we can agree we both wish for the same thing here for Poland, Europe and the transatlantic relations. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us for the conversation.
Thank you.